Along the lines of what I was just saying before the break about how suffering helps us develop compassion, there is a sorry, overcomes pride. There is a quote again. I'm sorry, I don't know where I got this from, but it says, "Suffering removes arrogance, and through sorrow one develops compassion, avoids sins, and rejoices in virtue." So these are some of the benefits. And then finally, in terms of looking at some of the benefits of problems and suffering, one great advantage is that all our difficulties that produce pain and suffering and discomfort to us, they're all causes for practicing patience. Patience is this very courageous, stable mind that is able to endure problems and difficulties by not getting angry. So anger is the most destructive. In the long term, it's not the most harmful of our delusions, because the most harmful, in fact, is our afflicted desire and attachment. But as the single most destructive disturbing thought is anger. When that thought arises, and it arises very strongly, then in a very brief moment we can create, you know, great harm to ourselves and others. Patience is basically developed. This is a huge topic which I won't go into here, but patience is basically developed by seeing the faults of anger and seeing the benefits of being patient, and seeing, understanding that there are actually no faults, no benefits in getting angry. There are no real benefits for oneself and others in getting angry. Anger, if we check as an emotion, as it disturbs the mind as one is experiencing it, it causes us, while we're under the control of it, to say and do things that we often regret, and those negative things we say and do can have long-term effects in this life. Every time we get angry, we are, you know, re-establishing the habit to get angrier, you know, more easily, more strongly. We're refreshing the imprint of that delusion. Anger, because it's a reflection of ignorance, is not seeing even the conventional nature of something correctly. When something or someone makes, as we say, makes us angry, you know, our perceptions of what is happening are completely distorted, so we can't make correct judgments while we're angry. Even in an ordinary way, we say and do the wrong things. But especially from a Dharma point of view, anger is really destructive, because it's creating these negative imprints that are only going to produce suffering in the lower realms, create the causes for us to have non-human suffering rebirths. When we have a human rebirth, we will experience all other kinds of suffering as a result of these imprints of anger. And what is even worse, from a Dharma point of view, from the Mahayana perspective, what is the worst aspect of getting angry and creating these negative imprints, is that these negative imprints of anger in our mind obscure our mind and make it very difficult to understand the Dharma, to practice it and realize it. So it acts as a great obstacle to the spiritual life. Even when it's not ripening, just when it's dormant in the mind, it has this effect of like burdening the mind. Making the mind dark, you know, metaphorically dark, you know, so that, and obscure, so that even, like if one has a lot of imprints of anger, but also other negative imprints from other disturbing thoughts, you know, when we hear the Dharma, it's very hard to make sense of it. Something that can be very easy to understand, we find very difficult because our mind is so obscured. So, So all of that really delays our spiritual evolution and therefore delays the time that we can be of real benefit to others. So from a Mahayana perspective, that is the worst aspect of getting angry. It's bad in the moment and from then on. There's nothing good about it. The more we deeply understand that, then we can practice patience. We don't focus on anger. We think of all the faults. While we're thinking of the faults, the energy to be angry is less and less, because you can't do, the mind cannot simultaneously do two opposite things. Right? So this is not suppressing anger, it's undermining the causes for it. So in following the spiritual life, you know, anger is a great obstacle, especially in following the Bodhisattva way of life, where we really want to help others, you know, to have the happiness of this life, the happiness of future lives, the everlasting happiness of nirvana, and the peerless of happiness of enlightenment. Then to get angry and hurt someone in any way is the worst thing we can possibly do. It's totally contrary to everything we're trying to do. So, you know, developing patience is an incredibly important spiritual quality. It's one of the keys, right? And how do you develop patience? In order to develop, what forces us to think about, you know, the harm of anger and the benefits of patience, what forces us to do this is having a difficult situation. In particular, patience is developed in relation to the three things. Other people, what we call the antagonist or the enemy, to our own, you know, inner disturbances and problems and suffering. And then the third kind of patience is the patience that voluntarily takes on the hardship of practicing the Dharma. Right? And ultimately, from a Dharma perspective, from someone trying to follow this path, this is the main patience that we need, the patience that is willing and able to take on, voluntarily take on the difficulties of practicing the Dharma. Yeah? So how, in a sense, how we build up the ability to have that patience is by having the patience that is able to deal especially with external enemies and problems. Yeah? You cannot practice patience with a friend. While a friend is being a friend, you don't get angry with them. Yeah? While life is going wonderfully well, and sometimes it does for some of us, sometimes when things are going smoothly, there is no way to practice patience. And you can say, well, if life is going smoothly, you don't need patience, ha-ha. But the point is, I'm sorry, folks, but life doesn't go on smoothly forever, because that's just a tiny little karmic blimp, a good karmic blimp that runs out, and what happens is a karmic blimp of bad karma ripens while we're in samsara. So we need, while we're in samsara, while we're practicing the spiritual path, we absolutely need patience. So what forces, the only thing that makes us patient is having an enemy, someone who annoys us, upsets us, goes contrary to the self-cherishing thought, and problems. Right? So this is a wonderful thing. So having enemies is actually terrific, they say, and because this is the way to practice patience. So also, if we don't have an enemy, also when we have, you know, problems for other reasons, again, we need to practice patience, not to get upset and overwhelmed. So this problem, this difficulty. And in fact, the worse it is, the more we need patience, right? So that is a great thing. And again, patience is very much connected with courage. The more patient we are, the more courageous we are. And it builds up, and it's all related with self-confidence. Yeah. Strength of mind, and therefore stability and courage. So all these things fit together. So that is a great benefit of problems. Especially if we just have one that we can deal with one at a time. Yeah? And train this way. Or to put it in modern language, if we never move out of, to quote someone from Hayagriva Center just recently, who was saying this to me, if we never, I can't capture their exact wonderful words, but it was something like, if we never move out of our comfort zone, we never grow. Yeah? That's what this is all about. You know, the self-cherishing thought just wants to sort of sit and wallow in its comfort zone. But in that, we never develop. And also, we in that state, which is what we think we want, we all think that we want this cozy little world where everything is wonderful, yeah. But in that state, we never grow, and we're in a state where we don't think we can grow. Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be any reason for it, but we're actually in a very kind of vegetative, you know, nothing situation. So every problem takes us out of that comfort zone and is telling us to grow, is forcing us to grow and develop, yeah, which we can do. Especially we should have this confidence now that we have met the Dharma, and hopefully we have some belief and confidence in it, we have some refuge in it, yeah, and therefore in our own inner qualities, then this is a good thing. This is what the gurus do. One of the jobs, first they pat you on the head and tell you what a nice, sweet little person you are, and they give you things and make you feel wonderful. And then when you're hooked and you feel the guru loves you and you love the guru, then the guru, depending on your character or anything, but sooner or later it happens, the job of a guru, a real teacher, is to destroy your ego, yeah, to absolutely obliterate one's ego. This is a painful process, because we ourselves don't want to do it. You know? In theory we do, as Buddhists in theory we do, but when it actually comes to it, I mean, really good Buddhists, but not like me. The really great ones, of course, they definitely want to do it. And of course we all understand, oh yes, I should do it, but well, do I really, really want to do it? When you're actually faced where you have to let go of stuff, it becomes very painful. Whereas the guru's job, because he doesn't care whether you like him, he or she likes you or not, because they have real compassion and they're completely, you know, stable, healthy people who don't depend on praise and all this kind of nonsense, then they're quite happy to give you a hard time. Yeah? Whether you scream or not and reject them. And they will do that. The very thing you don't want to do, they know you don't want that. You don't like that, so they tell you, do that. That's their job. And they do it beautifully. So this is what the enemy does too. The enemy does that. The enemy does exactly what you don't want. So this is good. This is a good thing. When we have the Dharma to understand, when we have that kind of perspective, therefore we can see the enemy as the guru. This is another way of transforming problems also, is to see every problem and difficulty as a manifestation of the guru, of the Buddha. If you don't have a guru yet, you do have a guru, which is the Buddha. That's why he's called Guru Shakyamuni Buddha. He is your teacher. He is your guide, your protector, your refuge. So everything that goes wrong with you, one can try and transform it by thinking that this hasn't happened just out of, it's not even my negative karma, this is actually my good karma, that the Guru is doing this for me, giving me this task, this challenge. I think I quoted at the beginning of this course, but or maybe it was in Perth, but this process of transforming problems is not something unique to Buddhism, although there is a unique Buddhist way of doing it. This is something that is shared by all the great mystics, the real mystics of the religious traditions of the world. And that's why they are such great beings, because what separates them from very ordinary people is that, like, an ordinary person doesn't want problems and has complete aversion to it. That these great mystics who became the great realized beings of the great religions of the world are people who had this incredible courage and compassion and renunciation, so that they could use problems and transform them and grow from them. Some of you may have heard of a German Christian mystic who lived in the Middle Ages sometime. His name is Meister Eckhart. He once said, "There is a marvelous comfort to be had when adversity serves as well as fortune. Then pain is like pleasure." So when we see that adversity is actually, there's a fortunate side to it, then that is a marvelous comfort to the mind. That is actually comforting to the mind. The mind can actually be happy when there is problems. The great practitioners can be happy when there is suffering, when there are problems. We can develop the state step by step. Right? And some modern author who, again, I keep forgetting to put this very bad habit of not putting the authors, but some modern author who was not even a Buddhist said recently, "Hardships and disasters are mere challenges to a boundless human ingenuity." So, moving rapidly along, what I'd like to start doing now is how we put all this together, this Lojong together, all these different things together, it's summarized in a practice which is called the Eight Verses of Thought Transformation. So this text is in your student material, it's the very first thing, and it's a brief commentary by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So His Holiness has taught on the eight verses a number of times, quite a few times, because although it's very short, it's an extremely popular text. It was written by a Tibetan Lama called Langri Tangpa, who was one of the Kadampa Geshis. And he composed this as a reminder of what he should do in difficult circumstances. So he would recite this to himself regularly whenever something bad happened in his life. And this text became incredibly popular as a very concise summary of how to practice thought transformation in daily life. And it's been taught in the Tibetan tradition in all the four schools of Tibetan ever since. And I've had the good fortune of receiving commentary on these eight verses and the Lung, the permission to... I've received that from His Holiness at least once, and from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and I've received the commentary from Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So these verses, you know, you could spend, or the la you not I, but the lamas could spend, you know, hours, days, weeks talking about each verse. So I'm only going to go through this extremely briefly. You do have this brief commentary on it, but there's also another commentary by His Holiness in this book, Transforming Problems. And if you see this book around, I think you may even have a copy in your library. It used to be a free little booklet by Wisdom. This also has another very brief commentary by His Holiness on the eight verses. So these eight verses are really wonderful. There are many different translations of them. So the first verse says, determined to accomplish all six, just briefly as way of introduction, the first seven verses are all about practicing thought transformation of bodhicitta, and the last verse, the eighth verse, is through practice. So the first seven verses are practicing through conventional means, from the conventional point of view, and the last verse is from the ultimate point of view, from the point of view of emptiness. So the first verse says, I'll have to try and give something about the first verse, is that one has to remember that when these Lojong teachings were first taught, they were taught secretly. They were never taught in public. The great gurus who held the lineage of these teachings that go back to Atisha, they only taught them to people, to students they knew who were really, you know, very, very strong practitioners, and they knew that if I taught this to this student, they will actually go out and do it. They won't just write it in a book and put it on a shelf and say, yes, yes, they will actually do it. So for hundreds of years, these teachings were kept secret. And then only at some point, one of these lamas thought, well, the teachings, you know, the times are getting very degenerate. And if we wait to teach only to really good practitioners, all the good practitioners will be dead before, the teachings will die out. So we better start teaching it to very ordinary people, and anyway, maybe they can make some use of it. So then it starts to be made public. But these were taught. We should bear in mind that these things, one way I know I shouldn't say this, but anyway, I can't help myself. They are difficult. Right, they're taught from the perspective of some people who are really bodhisattvas and who really do this and really want, not, they do it, they want to do it and actually enjoy doing it. You know, it brings real joy in their minds to do these things. So often when we as ordinary students look at these things, we say, oh, this is terrible, this is too difficult and this is weird, this is creepy, I don't want to do this. But we're looking from an extremely low, low perspective. And it's true, maybe we can't practice perfectly at that level now, but what we need to do is, you know, one way of looking at things produces suffering, and one way of looking at things helps and brings happiness. So what we should see is, rather than saying, oh, this is too difficult and complicated and some of it's kind of really, you know, off the planet, we should see that, you know, this is an ideal that I can aim towards, a way, it's a direction I can start to move my thinking, rather than stuck in this old worldly habit that everyone else has, which isn't really helping. This is something completely new, original, revolutionary. It's difficult, but I can start. You know, I may not get very far in this life, but this is a completely new way to go, right? So just that itself is something wonderful. And we don't have to beat ourselves that we can't do it very well yet and that we may fail many times. But that's a training. You know, this word training, you know, training is something you do again and again and again. Right? And like even with sports people, even if they're Olympic sport, at an Olympic standard, they still train. Right? You still have to keep doing it. Because if you don't, you fall back. The ordinary muscles, lose their power. If you don't train the mind, the strength of the mind fades away. So there's always training, right? And until, we really get there. So the first guideline in our life of transforming the mind is to think that, determined to accomplish all success, I shall always practice holding dear all sentient beings who are more precious than wish-fulfilling gems. So just very briefly, now so you've got at least one verse to think about, is that determined to accomplish all success, that refers to achieving enlightenment. If I'm determined to do that for myself and others because I realize that there's nothing better to do, to aim for that, there is no better thing to do in this life than to dedicate oneself to trying to practice, the Bodhisattva way of life, trying to achieve enlightenment. Of course, I'm not going to do it in this life, but whatever I accomplish in this life, motivated by that thought, is incredibly beneficial for me and others now and in the future. There's nothing better I can possibly do. So if I've got that attitude, that motivation, that is really colouring my whole perspective of who I am, what I can do, what life is about, that's what I really want to try and achieve. As I said at the beginning, which was all quoting Lama Zopa Rinpoche about the four kinds of happiness, and there's just ultimately one goal, that's very clear. With that kind of mind that Rinpoche has, in his mind, there's only one thing he's trying to do, which is to achieve, well, he has achieved enlightenment, but to enlighten everyone, yeah? To bring about those four kinds of happiness, especially number four, the peerless happiness of enlightenment. When the mind is infused with that goal, right, then I shall. Then the thing is, what will help bring that about is always practicing holding all sentient beings as more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. A wish-fulfilling jewel, I don't know if they really exist. If I have a refuge, I should believe that these jewels actually exist. But according to Mahayana, or not even Mahayana, but Buddhist mythology or belief, there are these amazing things called wish-fulfilling jewels that exist way down in the depths of the ocean, that if you find them and you do a little bit of magic practice with them, whatever you wish will come true. It's kind of like Aladdin's lamp, the Buddha's Aladdin's lamp. But the point is, these wishes are only worldly wishes. Yeah, you can, whatever worldly wish you have, you will get it if you get one of these wish-fulfilling gems. So, as you've probably all heard me say before, it's a little bit like winning the lotto or getting a kind of credit card. Somehow, with this thing, magically, you can have whatever you want from a worldly sense. But the point is that by relying on other sentient beings, it's actually much better. Each sentient being is much more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, because even if we found one of these amazing things, or we won, the biggest lottery in the world, all we would have was some money. As Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, even if we somehow had a mountain of diamonds, we possessed a mountain of diamonds, like as big as Mount Everest, or as big as this earth, a mountain of diamonds, we possess that. What can you do with that? It's not going to make you happy. It's not going to stop you dying. It's not going to stop us getting sick. It's not going to stop people insulting us. It's not going to stop people not liking us, being kind to us. You can't eat it. You have to change it for stuff to be able to buy, get some food. I mean, you can do some nice things with a mountain of diamonds for sure, but not the real things. It can't bring real happiness. It doesn't stop death. It doesn't stop lower rebirths. literally, quite literally, you know, even if you had a mountain of emeralds and diamonds and everything else, a mountain of platinum credit cards, nothing is useless, pretty useless. Whereas what this verse is saying is that what we need to understand is that by being kind to sentient beings, by treating them nicely, we will achieve every happiness. Yeah. That each sentient being, quite literally, you know, our relationship with each sentient being by relating to them in a positive way, no matter how they relate to me, if I relate to them in a positive way, the benefit I get is far, far greater than having a mountain of diamonds. Literally, not just being cute, literally. Yeah. Because by being kind to sentient beings and, you know, practicing generosity, practicing the six perfections on, you know, in relation to other sentient beings, practicing patience and all these things, practicing compassion, one will create the causes to achieve liberation and enlightenment. You can't do that with a mountain of wish-fulfilling jewels. You just can't do it. But with sentient beings, you can. So they are incredibly precious. Literally. And even more, my teacher points out, it's not just that the totality of sentient beings is precious. It's even just one sentient being is more precious than anything we could ever accumulate in this world. No. Much more precious. And what even more interesting, you know, this says all sentient beings. So this, if we can be act like this to all sentient beings, not just the friends. Remember how we see sentient beings as friends, strangers, and enemies. So if we treat all and every sentient being as precious, then that's how to accomplish the great success of enlightenment. So not just being kind to friends or strangers, but especially, as Lama Sutta Rinpoche says, especially with the enemy. The enemy is the most precious sentient being of all. If we can maintain equanimity and a positive mind in relation to the enemy, this is the most wonderful thing. So if we can, when we look at, you know, in our reactions, in our relationships with every sentient being that we come in contact with, if we were just to have that awareness that by relying on this person, I can achieve enlightenment, I can achieve a good rebirth, I can achieve everlasting happiness of nirvana, I can achieve the peerless happiness of enlightenment. I actually depend on this person. I depend on this person for that. So if we could bear that in mind, then we can see that this person is actually this person who I'm looking at now, who I'm interacting with now, no matter how, you know, whether friend, enemy, or stranger, this person is actually precious to me. Isn't that an amazing thought? It's an amazing thought. We don't have it. We don't think of sentient beings as precious. We have attachment to our family and friends, but even then, do we see them as absolutely precious in this way? But this is what the Bodhisattva practicing thought transformation does. So there's no way I can harm this being. They're absolutely vital to my well-being. They're incredibly precious. So how fortunate that this being exists. Sometimes when thinking about the bodhicitta teachings and how it says, you know, we're encouraged to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, I'm going to become a Buddha and then I'm going to make everyone else a Buddha. It sounds like we're doing a terrific thing for others, how fantastic we are. But actually, in every situation, I need the help of others. I want to help others, but to help others, I have to become a Buddha. The only way I can become a Buddha is by relying on others. To become a Buddha, I have to generate bodhicitta. To generate bodhicitta, I have to generate compassion. To generate compassion, I have to feel for others. These others have to exist. If they don't exist, I can't generate any of these good qualities. I can't become enlightened. I can't become liberated. I can't become enlightened. So it's not like I'm doing fantastic things for others. Others are doing fantastic things for me. So incredibly precious. So this is the first of the verses of transforming the mind, a new way of thinking about sentient beings. In our world now, and sadly more and more, people see others as things to use. Through this person, I will gain something, but something worldly, yeah. We manipulate and others for our own advantage. Here, it's completely, and in that situation, we don't see them as a living, feeling, suffering being. Yeah? We're just using them as a thing for our own gratification. Here, we're seeing this each being, no matter who they are, what their situation, as completely precious. I wish I could do this, but many, many years ago in Dharamsala, where Lama Zopa Rinpoche has a... He rarely goes there now, unfortunately, but this is where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives, and we have a centre called Tushita Retreat Centre, which is where Kyabje Trijang Rinpoche, the junior tutor of the Dalai Lama, used to live when he first came from Tibet. Or not first, but soon after he came from... He lived there for a short time, and Lama Yeshe used to love Tushita. It was one of his favourite places to be. He loved it. And anyway, Rinpoche has the centre there. So what was my point? So one day, I was standing on the path in the garden of that place with a friend, Greg Carr, who actually lives in Perth. We were standing there, and there was a slug walking across the path, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche came along from his little house and looked at the bug and then gave us an entire lecture on how this, through this bug, you know, we can achieve enlightenment. How incredibly kind, how precious this bug is. This little kind of gooey, gooey, slimy, kind of totally insignificant thing was crawling like a... you know, so slowly across this bit of cement. And Rinpoche gave this entire teaching on the Lam Rim about this bug. It was amazing. Another time, I think the very first time, no, maybe the second time, it was also in Dharamsala, I had an interview with Rinpoche in his little room. He had this tiniest little room in the world. And I went in and asked some question, some dumb question. And I can't even remember. And Rinpoche pointed, there was a spider in the corner. So he gave this whole talk to me about the spider and how people have aversion. Look, you know, you wouldn't want to have a body like that, you know, with all those little skinny legs and all this. And people, just by looking at you, are afraid of you. And he went on and on about how... Anyway. So by looking at sentient beings in particular ways, one can learn the whole Dharma. The whole Dharma can come into our mind if we look at them in the right way. One way of looking, one way of thinking produces every kind of suffering, and one way of looking produces every kind of benefit. Every kind of benefit. So that's what we have to transform our mind, to stop thinking in the wrong way and think the way bodhisattvas do. That's what Lojong is. That's what thought transformation. Think like a bodhisattva. Think like a Buddha. And when we're thinking like that, we will become. In that moment, we are bodhisattvas and Buddhas. Yeah. Oh, sorry. The director has given that terrifying raise of the eyebrow. I'm in deep trouble. I'm sorry, there's no question, no discussion time tonight. Any questions, comments, criticisms, arguments? Debates?
What's the role of empowerment in one's
act? Well, empowerments are part of the tantric tradition, and tantra is basically, in a nutshell, there'll be a DB course next year. This is the last Discovering Buddhism course for the year. Well, next year we'll start off with the course on emptiness and then on tantra. But basically, tantra is the quick way to achieve enlightenment. The general teachings that we're discussing now are the main things that we have to generate in our mind stream to achieve enlightenment. But then tantra is the way to bring about all these realizations that are taught in the Lam Rim teachings, in the graduated path teachings, to bring them about very, very quickly. And so for that to happen, our mind has to be empowered. There has to be this kind of empowerment, this energy that we receive somehow that can transform our mind. Just like this Lojong is a new way of thinking about ourselves and problems. So tantra is also basically a fundamental aspect of tantra is a way of actually not just thinking but actually seeing, seeing actually in the sense of seeing with your eyes, but also seeing with your mind the oneself and others and the entire world, the entire universe in a completely different way. And to be able to do that, to really be able to do that, we have to, there has to be a radical shift in our mind. And that is accomplished by taking empowerments from beings who have achieved that radical shift in their minds. Yeah. So in a sense, when you do a full level, the highest level tantric empowerment, in a sense, ideally what will happen, it's never happened to me, because I'm the dodo of the... anyway. But it's like you're kind of, because they talk about a mandala. A mandala is actually, what is a mandala? I don't know what a mandala. A mandala is like the mind of a deity. So an empowerment is helping you to enter that mandala, to see the universe, your own universe, your own reality in a completely different way, in a pure way, in a totally pure way. And of course, for us as ordinary people, just one empowerment will not do that. Unless one, if we're just at a very ordinary level, that one empowerment won't do that. But, something happens, because it's a dependent arising, depending on the nature of the guru, how realized the guru is, how much devotion we have, how much concentration, how pure our mind is, how much merit we have, depending on all these things. When the empowerment happens, then a certain amount of effect happens. But so we need to do this many, many times. And the empowerment sort of energizes us to do these tantric practices of visualizing oneself as a deity and so on, that brings about this very rapid generation of renunciation, wisdom and bodhicitta. That's it in a nutshell, isn't it? Something like that. Yeah, and these days the Lama say, like, unfortunately, most of us are not really qualified to receive empowerments, but it's like these teachings. If they were kept for the people who really could practice them, they would have died out. So the same, especially with Tantra, if Tantra had only, the initiations had only been given to people, had been reserved and kept secret and given only to the people really ready to practice them, they would have died out a long time ago. So the lamas, in their great compassion, started giving them to less and less qualified people, so that at least we have the imprints in our mind, so that in another life we can practice, even if we can't in this life. But we also can in this life. Definitely, as an ordinary person doing tantric practice, it definitely has effect on the mind. It really helps purify the mind and bring about change in the mind. Definitely, it speeds up one's understanding of the Lam Rim. As my teacher Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, what is special, what makes Tantra special is the three principal paths of renunciation, wisdom and bodhicitta. If you've got those, then Tantra works. And as you're practicing Tantra, it enables your realizations of those three things to become deeper, more profound. So these two things really go together. That's why Lama Yeshe, in his incredible wisdom, when he came to the West, started making Tantra, the highest yoga Tantra, available very easily and quickly, even though he was highly criticized by the Galupa Lamas, saying, oh, all these barbaric Westerners aren't ready for this. But Lama taught it because it's really helpful, even at our level. It really does something for the mind. Depending on, it's not a miracle, it's a dependent arising, depending on your faith and understanding and devotion and these things and keeping the vows correctly and all this kind of stuff. Okay, thank you very much. So the homework for the coming week, if you could please read this article by His Holiness, pages 3 to 13 on the 8 verses of thought transformation. At the very least, if you could at least read the actual verses, which are in bold print, so you get some idea of the verses themselves. And if you've got time, please read all the commentary. But if not, at least read over the commentary to verse 1 and 2, or verse 1 to 3. If you can read it all, that's great. And please reflect on those as much as you can. And also, if you can do some meditation on what I hope people tried during the last week, which was this analytical meditation of the points I've covered last week and this week on the way to look at the benefits of problems, right? Because that's what we have to imprint in our mind. We already have this very deep imprint that problems are bad, 100% bad. What we're trying to imprint in our mind is that there are these other good aspects. So we have to, reflect on that again and again. Don't have the pride that says, I got it, I heard it, I remember that, I know that. That's only like at the most superficial, it's at the top of the iceberg of the mind. We're trying to get all of that down to the very bottom of the iceberg, which is hundreds of feet under the ocean, right? That's where we want this understanding, not wobbling at the top, the peak of the iceberg, but right at the bottom. And the only way to do that is to reflect on these again and again and again, and never say, now I've got it, until you actually have, because you'll get this realization one day when you sit on your cushion and suddenly, bingo, But even then, you have to still meditate on it, because if you don't, the realization will go away, because it's impermanent. Okay, thank you very much. So we can dedicate the merits, the positive imprints that we've generated tonight. We should be very happy that we've done this. We can rejoice. And also please rejoice that your other Dharma brothers and sisters have come here and made these positive imprints. So we can dedicate this to quickly achieving enlightenment for the benefit of all the kind suffering mother sentient beings who are drowning in so many problems but have no method to transform them. Finish with three postulations to the triple gem.